This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's your host, Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, it's a real pleasure to welcome back to Greening of the Great Lakes Michigan State University President Luana Simon. President Simon, about every year this time, we have a new anniversary of the show. This is our fourth anniversary, and you've been so good to come on. You know, I think a lot of our listeners need to be reminded that you had a lot to do with the genesis not only of our program, but of our website, greeningofthegreatlakes.com. So welcome back to the program.
Well, thank you very much. And you've done an extraordinary job along with Russ White in making this a program that was not only an idea, but a program that's listened to by many across the Great Lakes.
Well, thank you very much. Hey, let's begin. Let's get right to it. The Office of Campus Sustainability and the Be Spartan Green Initiative. We've been doing sustainability long before sustainability was in vogue. How is the Be Spartan Green Initiative? We're right in the middle of football season, and we're doing a lot of great things in recycling and all that. But are you pleased with where that initiative is, and where are we going with it?
Well, I think we've got a lot of momentum on campus where being Spartan Green, thinking about sustainability, is very much a part of our daily life. If you look at the goals that were established by many universities, they tend to be goals that are 20-year goals. And we tried to think about goals that could be 5, 10, 15, and 20-year goals, not simply to say, gee whiz, by 2025 or whatever the number is, we'll be achieving these objectives. So I think that it's easy to look at recycling, and almost every campus is doing some form of recycling now. I think our unique commitment to recycling is really the Recycling Center and being part of trying to move material back into a useful life, not simply collecting material or plastics in a bin. Also, I think on our recycling efforts, we've made it available to the public, which many universities do not do because of the potential cost to the university. So I think that's really useful. And when I go drive by the public area for recycling on a weekend, there are always three or four cars there along with mine depositing cardboard or newspapers. And we're also doing, I think, some exciting things with green glass that I think will pay dividends in the long run, but still is not viewed as a very cost-effective opportunity now. If I look at other goals, we do compete with Michigan on the athletic field, but I was curious because of their big announcement about the planet being blue. Which most people in the world would not believe to be true, that they would think it was green, but their goals were really 2025 goals. And when I looked at their greenhouse emission was 25% for us, we will take, a pretty aggressive energy transition plan to the board, and ours has to be very aggressive because we do produce our own power. But we've already achieved a 9% reduction in greenhouse emissions just in the last year. Mm-hmm. And that's really, I think, terrific work if you think about an overall goal of reducing greenhouse emissions by 30% or more to have 9% in 1 year.
You're one-third of the way there.
We're already one-third of the way there, and we haven't attacked some of those issues. If you think about vehicle output, we've already reduced significantly our vehicle output. We already have many hybrid cars in place, hybrid buses, because we partner with CATA, and that's just going to continue miles per gallon using some bio-based fuels. Electric vehicles are all part of the campus environment now. We just need to continue to work on that and be sure that we can employ new technologies. We already have a plan about river runoff and stormwater usage that's been in place for quite a while. our food stores, they were looking at 20% of their purchases by 2025 from local suppliers.
From local producers.
We're already at 57% from local.
57%.
Of our products come from Michigan companies. If you look at lead construction, we've been doing that for a while. The Secchia building is an example of that. We've already joined the ASHE STARS program in 2009. We've received a silver certificate in April because we wanted to have external validation. We've had solar panels on the pavilion since 2003.
Right.
We've talked about the anaerobic digester we're going to put on the farm to continue both research as well as activities. The BOT building is going to be our first geothermal building. It's a very large addition to the College of Nursing for research space. So I think we're doing things in a positive way. You're never going to do enough at any given moment from the perspective of people who believe that cost is not a factor.
Right.
So what we have to do with our energy transition plan, which will be announced after the first of the year for the campus to be able to look at, is how do we balance cost and sustainability, and how do we become a place where we can be engaged in new technology development that is applicable not simply here but in other situations around the world. And those are tough balances. The students are very upset that I don't just make an announcement that by 2025 we'll not use coal. I could make that announcement, but it's a PR announcement. It's not a plan that really will put us in a position to be without coal. I think that we will be burning, we'll be burning biomass. We do want to be a part of research on clean coal technology because coal will be a part of the world. And we're also using more gas, which is also, I remind them, a fossil fuel that has its own issues. Nuclear was a part of the program that we looked at. That's sort of gone out of favor again. But
is that primarily because of what happened in Japan, do you think, or are there other issues as well?
I think so. I mean, but I think what we were looking for was not a major nuclear power plant, but a small nuclear plug-and-play fourth or fifth addition to our power plant. That could deal with future energy needs. I still think that technology is a good technology, though controversial, and can be looked at as a research opportunity as well. But it's not the same as building a nuclear power plant that provides the nuclear power for huge regions.
Right.
So there's a lot of possibilities, and we're very much committed to doing that. But we're a place that doesn't just make pronouncements. We have plans.
Yeah. And I know you're going to the board, you said, with an energy transition plan. And I know you don't like to get ahead of your board at all, President Simon, but can you give us any hints on what that might look like for our listeners?
Well, I think it will require us looking at energy conservation, the role we can play in smart grid technology, because it's not just about producing power, and then how we can produce power differently. So I think it's going to have all of those aspects. Interestingly, the student groups that are most protesting the fact that we haven't made a pronouncement are a part of the committee. So the committee that's engaged has faculty experts, it has external experts, and it has students who feel passionately about various issues. They're all having to deal with the reality of taking your passion and making it into a workable plan. I think it'll have a pretty aggressive target. And we'll also, in addition to sharing it more publicly in January, we'll have it be available to the university community to see if there are technologies that we've sort of discounted that they believe should be included more heavily in the plan. It's very, very, it's a very analytical model. And so it tells you if you do this, it might cost you more over here. It's also dynamic so that we can continue to project in the future and see if we can have more aggressive goals.
You've always been real passionate about making students part of a solution to problems. You've done that from your provost days and now in your presidency. But, you know, the recycling center, the thing that you started with, is a good case in point because students were a primary motivator for getting that thing started and getting that done.
They were, and Vice President Poston and I had talked about trying to do a recycling center early on when I was provost, and people were very concerned about not making the numbers work. But we felt, and when I became president, the students was one of the first board meetings when I was president. The students came and sort of argued about for a recycling center.
As only students can do.
And Fred and I sort of smiled at one another because we had already been talking about having a recycling center. And so it gave us an opportunity to do what we've done in the energy, which is to put together a committee, faculty, staff, and students, think about the best way to do this so that it's not simply a word, but that we can really actually move forward on getting more and more people to recycle and to think about it as a part of their daily lives. And so the students were the impetus. They remain passionate about it. We're trying to recycle food waste in Brody, which is a difficult task. It sounds simple, but it's not an easy task to make work. Interestingly enough, there are rules about mixing animal waste and food waste, which I'd never imagined there would be in terms of how you sell compost and do other things. And so we're learning about how to do that and to do that effectively. But I think we've made it both a passion as a set of researchable questions. And a great thing about a university is that you always have people who are pushing you to do more because of their own passions.
Mm-hmm. Well, and students being part of this committee for the energy transition, I mean, that's going to give them great lessons in how you balance sustainability and economic reality as well, which can only help them going forward in their careers.
I think so. And some of them are learning that it's okay, as I've told the Stop Coal group. I mean, that's fine that you want to protest and want me to make this grand pronouncement. But I'm not a politician. And so I'm going to make it in the context of a commitment that we think we can deliver on, even though it's a long-term commitment. And it's great to have those passions. I think that universities are enriched by those kinds of passions.
You're listening to Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Your host is Dr. Kirk Heinze.
We're back with special guest Luana Simon, president of Michigan State University. Let's turn our focus. Michigan State's long been a world grant as well as a land grant university. We have faculty members and students all over the world. I've had the pleasure of doing some study abroad programs with students focusing on sustainability myself. But as you look around the globe, there's a lot of rhetoric coming out of a lot of countries. There's some substance in some cases, and not much substance in others. What worries you from a sustainability standpoint as you look across the globe?
Well, I think that people will always dispute numbers. But what I worry about is how we not simply talk about sustainability, but talk about sustainability in the context of being able to feed 9 billion people. That's the projection of the planet. Because you can't sustain a peaceful globe and you can't sustain the kind of economic growth one needs for a peaceful globe if you can't feed people. I mean, I think it's that simple. And so what I'm most interested in is not the rhetoric about sort of sustainability on one hand and water quality on the other and food, but how we put those pieces together in a way that creates a world that we would want to live in and that people can prosper in and that the planet can also be sustained. And that's a much more difficult challenge than simply deciding that there's global warming and you have to sort of reduce greenhouse gases or do whatever the short-term solutions are. And the solutions that we need to find have to work in highly industrialized, developed parts of the world, and they have to work quickly in developing parts of the world. And we can't just take the solutions that would work for the developing countries and map them to the developed world and vice versa. We have to have a multiple prong strategy that permits growth and prosperity across the spectrum, and that's going to be an enormously difficult challenge.
Enormously difficult, but it is encouraging, too, that we have MSU faculty and students and not only those urban areas you mentioned and the highly industrialized areas, but we also have people working on the ground with poor farmers in Rwanda or Thailand or you name it, and you know these programs.
Right, and I think that you know, as one thinks about the urbanization of the planet that will occur, is occurring now, as cities are being built of mammoth proportion in China and will need to be built in India and are being built even not the same scale but still an urbanization in Africa. We have to really think about how to make better sense of the urban food issues because it takes energy to transport food. And that adds enormous cost. And so if you're looking at the environmental footprint of food and the food chain, you have to really become very, very creative about how we're going to balance urban food systems where they are a source of growing, how we're going to deal with processing nearer at hand to reduce the footprint of the food chain, and at the same time how we're going to get safe and affordable food supplies around the world. It's a very interesting set of issues. I'm really pleased that Michigan State is at the forefront of that in a global way because the solutions in urban settings, whether you're in São Paulo or Chennai or Amsterdam or Detroit, are going to be the same. And there's a real opportunity to learn from one another and to share ideas. And it's just not sort of plowing up land and growing corn.
That was an old model.
That was a very old model, and I think as the scientists will tell you, there's a lot of soil and other issues about that. But I think there is a enormous opportunity to look at ways to extend growing seasons and to better coordinate the networks of people who are now growing food in urban settings for humanitarian as well as small economic farmers, and really to think about the co-op model that was a part of agriculture a long time ago and making sense of that.
And making sense of it from an indigenous perspective.
Right.
Not just taking our co-op model and applying it.
But really creating something new. And also, I think, using the knowledge of supply chains, because we had a graduate student who did a bit of a project for Dave Close, the chair of our logistics supply chain program, actually the number one program in the country. So we should probably do
it is number one, U.S. News and World Report.
Plug there, who looked at food distribution because many of these not-for-profits are struggling for funding and decided that if you use supply chain techniques and really instead of the way these have grown up in somewhat chaotic and overlapping geographic ways, that if you use supply chain techniques and they partner together, there was actually ways that we could deliver more food to people rather than less in these difficult economic times. So it's not just about agriculture or food. It's about how we develop systems that make sense. And what Mike Hamm and his team are doing
down in the urban areas
is really looking at that coalition of food and food-oriented community groups and how you begin to align them into a system that works for them not and their setting. And then can we take that system and can it be applied in other urban settings around the world to help this problem and jumpstart the learning? But also, the concept of vertical agriculture is one that's actually been around for a long time. and it's ripe for technological advancement. We really haven't been able to develop the systems that we need and the technologies we need to make this really viable economically. We can get an old building and we can, you know, put lights in and we can grow things. But how to make that really economically viable and get the quality of food that we need, and also to do it in a volume where we can package the food so that it can be made available in urban areas in an effective way, recognizing that there are few grocery stores in urban areas and we need to fix that. But how do you package it differently so that you can take food grown in the city, but also, let's say, food grown in Michigan and package apples and fresh fruits and vegetables so that they have a longer life and that can be distributed in different ways. And I think there's some fascinating research issues. There are really actually new technologies that need to be developed. And my big vision for Michigan, which may be not be a very good vision, is if you think about this sort of urban food systems issues, that I believe, much like Singapore, where if you think of Singapore right now, they're a hub for water-based research. They're a hub for the manufacturing of new and novel technologies about water reclamation and recycling. And they're also an intellectual hub if you look at their World Water Conference that brings people from around the world, the companies from around the world, to think and talk about issues about water. Wouldn't it be neat if 20 years from now, because of what we were doing in urban settings in Michigan, that we could develop the innovative companies that were really looking at the technology innovations necessary to deal with food in urban settings, in either buildings or on land.
So that we essentially become the Singapore.
Become the Singapore of the issues of urban food. Because everybody knows that in the future, there is going to be this urban food issue. I mean, it's just whatever expert you talk about, we know it's there. But the question is how that we can turn that not from a problem into the same kind of economic advantage for cities in Michigan that Singapore was able to do in water and water-based technology. I think we have the engineering talent in Michigan. Mm-hmm. I think we have the innovative talent in Michigan. I think we know a lot about food and food systems and water systems and the interface of energy, food, and water from the work that we've done and others. And I think this is an enormous opportunity to take this from just sort of how do you get food to people to how can you create the industry and have this be one of the world's hubs in thinking about those issues in the future. And with the
I think that's a pretty exciting vision, actually.
And with the water we have in the Great Lakes and with the need for more effective energy, going back to the question of how we become a model, there are just a number of really neat things that could happen in a big vision that's just not about recycling or about, gee whiz, what do we use to produce electricity, or gee whiz, we have a problem and I want to take a building and turn it into something. It really is much more sophisticated. And wouldn't it be neat if we could get some major corporations to want to put an R&D operation in Detroit or Flint around the technology it would take to do this effectively? Because some of the technologies require too much water.
Yes.
As an example, in terms of the vertical technologies, how do we essentially reclaim soil better? There are really important scientific issues about microbes that could be used to reclaim soil differently.
Reclaim soil to reduce pathogens in soil.
But also to make the environment safer, because how do you take some of those neighborhoods and make them safer for people in terms of a health issue? Mm-hmm. And how can you make them healthier in terms of access to high quality, low cost food? So you know, I think that's really exciting if we have this big vision and not just simply get hung up about whether we have 40 acres and some crop.
Yeah.
And it's been hard to get people to think about the bigger vision because everybody wants a widget of some sort.
Actually, you anticipated my last question, which is what keeps you awake at night related to sustainability. This vision must keep you awake at night in terms of the possibilities. I mean, clearly universities have a major role in moving a vision like that forward. If not universities like Michigan State, then who does it?
Well, I think that's the advantage of being a global university. In some ways, the prototype of a global university going back to the 1950s on the kinds of issues that will affect the planet significantly, food, water, environment, and the capacity to think about the need to move the prosperity curve, whether you're in a poor village in Rwanda or a struggling city in the United States. Mm-hmm. And it's how to create this bigger vision for a future that embraces multiple aspects. It simply isn't driven by one, because the sustainability of any one of these ideas is depending on having a much more complex system that really actually works together and aligns together.
Well, a recent book out of Harvard suggests that there's less violence in the world today primarily because of education, and there'll be greater sustainability in the world of tomorrow primarily because of education.
I think that's true, but I also think that the stability of the world going forward will depend on the capacity to feed people.
Yep.
And I think you could imagine if there is a world where hunger is rampant because of the population changes, that will not be a very stable world.
Yeah.
And we really have the opportunity today to invest in the technologies for tomorrow that can assure that sustainable world remains a peaceful world.
I think I can think of a better way to close the interview. I've been talking with Luana K. Simon, president of Michigan State University. Luana, thanks so much for your support of this program, and thanks for being back on the show.
And Kurt, to you and Russ, thank you for what have been four great years, but also what will happen in the future in terms of continuing to talk about these important issues, not only from a theoretical perspective, but from a very practical perspective as it affects the lives of people in Michigan and the Great Lakes.
That was Greening of the Great Lakes with Dr. Kirk Heinze on MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Find more online at greeningofthegreatlakes.com.
And for more MSU Today, visit us on the web at msutoday.com.
You're tuned to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
Hi, it's Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association. We've all heard the expression, it's all about who you know. And wherever you are on your career ladder, having a friend on the inside can make all the difference. When you join the MSU Alumni Association family, you're instantly connected to 500,000 Spartans around the world, many of whom are key decision makers in just about every major enterprise. Whether you're looking for a way in or a way up, your MSU Alumni Association affiliation can help you link up with that MSU alum who'll always take your call just because you're a Spartan. Building your network right now before you need it is the best possible career insurance, and joining the MSU Alumni Association is the best possible way to get the most out of your Spartan life. Learn more online at alumni.msu.edu. That's alumni.msu.edu. The MSU Alumni Association, your personal network for life.
MSU Ag Bio Research, leading innovation in food, natural resources, and energy.
Well, one of the things we want listeners to know is how connected we are, that we're in a response mode of addressing real life problems in the real world here in Michigan.
Dr. Steve Pepke leads MSU Ag Bio Research.
Well, we're everywhere. We're the face of MSU across the state, in the local communities, with infrastructure and research expertise to address those local problems. MSU Ag BioResearch is the research engine that undergirds the food and agricultural industry in the state, that undergirds our natural resource usage, recreational usages of sport, fishing, forestry, all of those things. And of course, with the recent interest in renewable energy, we have in a very big way moved into this arena as well.
MSU Ag BioResearch.
The University Research Corridor, empowering Michigan.
This is an association of the three research universities in Michigan to really collaborate on a deeper level than we have in the past and highlight for ourselves and for the region and for the nation the strength in technology, innovation, new research, investment that we think is going to help change the Michigan economy.
That's University of Michigan President Mary Sue Coleman.
The mission of the URC is no less than to help transform the Michigan economy and to make this a vibrant place that young people will want to come and stay, that businesses will want to be in, because we are a place where a lot is happening, and we have the brain power for the new economy. It's here. It's in Michigan. We just need to tap it.
Visit us online at urcmich.org.
So Michigan is vibrant. Michigan has all these things, and we want to signal that to the entire world.
Visit the University Research Corridor online at urcmich.org.
This is MSU Today with Russ White on AM 870 WKAR.
Along with MSU Athletic Director Mark Hollis, I'm Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association, sitting in for President Luana K. Simon, who's on assignment. I recently had the great honor of attending a celebration of the MSU women's basketball team's first outright Big Ten championships. While a name like Susie Merchant may get most of the press as MSU's most recognizable face in the world of women's athletics, the untold story behind the growth and success of our programs here centers on another name. Shelley Applebaum is the Senior Associate Director of Athletics at Michigan State University, and perhaps more than anyone, she has been the wind beneath the wings of the transformation of women's sports at MSU. How many sports did you play as a kid?
Just about any that were made available. And way back, Scott, just growing up in Bowling Green, Ohio, really swimming, a swim club was my first opportunity at organized sport, and that was in fourth grade. My high school did not start programs for girls' sports until I was a freshman. So I always tell a story of an undefeated season. We were 2-0. We played two games. We played the same team home and away. And the season lasted 2 weeks. So many times we laugh about it. We've shed a few tears over it. But literally, that was how I was exposed to opportunities officially in the school systems, and have tried over the last 30 years to make sure that both men and women, girls and boys, would get opportunities, because in many cases, people haven't had those.
We really have seen a change in women's sports over the years. And it's, you know, when you talk about change, many times people look at it as ancient times, and it's really not ancient times when you go back to looking at women's basketball being played in an IM gym after the wrestling team just happened to gets done with practice. And for a long time, Michigan State did not, like many other programs, did not provide letter jackets, did not provide any kind of recognition for women's sports as we were going through the system. And actually, I talk about a little bit the presentation of those letters and then what it's evolved to today. As far as the pride, where we're inclusive, we're together, we're kind of hand in hand as it relates to varsity sports at Michigan State and nationwide.
Absolutely. When I came here in January of 1999, I was really impressed with the university's commitment at the highest levels, including at the athletic department level, for equity, just trying to do the right thing for both men and women. And when Clarence Underwood was our athletic director and Mark was one of the senior associates, we talked a lot about we had many women from 1981 and prior that had never received their letters. And when you think about in sport, your jacket is your rite of passage. It's a way to have a tangible sign that you're a Spartan for life. And so I was given a lot of support, and our staff worked very, very hard with many different grassroots committees. And there's a picture in my office of a woman who was 88 years old, Eugenie Westhauser, who played field hockey when FDR was president, and she had never received her letter. So in February of 2002, when we tied it into National Girls and Women in Sport Day, we sold out the Kellogg Center. We had over 600 people there, and we had people from the 80s going back to the 30s, and we had sisters, and we had mothers and daughters, and we had former coaches come back, and our current student athletes and staff. And I remember Clarence saying that with 3 degrees from Michigan State and over 50 years tied to this campus in some capacity, it was the most moving event he was ever a part of. And I think the great part of it was just the Spartan pride, but they never felt whole until that day. So you'll see many women in their 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s that are now wearing their jacket. And for some of them, they waited decades for that opportunity. And it was just an example of Michigan State doing something really special. A few other schools had done it. And then one of the things that I'm really proud of is that we've helped many other schools do it since then. And from the time that Mark stepped foot on this campus, you know, as an associate, a senior associate, now as director, he's always been about doing something that's creative, innovative, but also tying the past to the present. And that was a great example of an event that has made an impact. And I think we've continued to try to move in the direction where we can always do something new and special.
What is the essence of a successful team?
In my opinion, I think it's about when opportunity and passion come together, and it's about honoring the game and the people that are a part of it. And I think when you're talking about trying to win and pursue victory with honor, I think it's really tied into that. And I think when you think about a carrier game and honoring the military that, you know, fight for our freedom, you know, sport's something that's fun. It's something that's enjoyable. And I've always believed that sport delivers hope. People want a team to cheer for. So I think if you have the privilege to be a participant or a coach or to be in that staff that's around it, or if you're a spectator, I think it gives you a chance to really just focus in on competition and being able to have a team that matters to you. And whether you win or lose, it's just about having that experience.
Shelley serves on the Big Ten joint council with myself and Mike Casavana, where most all of the big decisions of the Big Ten, other than those that the presidents have oversight with, are decided. She's also on the championship cabinet with the NCAA, so plays a big leadership role in a broad range of sports. On campus, one of her assignments is gender equity in Title IX. And I think for the listener, if you could just kind of go through and describe how you think those two things are different and what they mean on campus, and then maybe we can go into some of the issues related to both as we apply them here at Michigan State.
Sure. Well, first of all, the university has a Title IX coordinator, and that's Paulette Granberry Russell. Within athletics, as Title IX pertains to sport, that's where I've been involved, and it's a pleasure to do that. And Kathy Lindahl, for many years before me, certainly led the charge as well. And I think when you look at opportunities, you're trying to provide something that would be equitable, that one side would say, this is absolutely something that's acceptable and it's something that we value. And I really believe that Michigan State has been a leader, and the Big Ten has, for that matter. When we really look at participation rates and granting scholarship opportunities, our conference has led nationally with many initiatives. And at Michigan State, we've certainly put people in a position to be successful. So I think it's at a grassroots level. It's certainly trying to be tied into conference and then national and federal law, but trying to make sure that you have a safe harbor and that you're in a situation where your student athletes, coaches, and staff can feel good about the resources. Mark always talks about pursuing championships, and we've put our programs in a position to do that here.
The NCAA has a rule book that's getting to be as thick as Webster's Unabridged Dictionary. How do the rules impact your ability to field a competitive team at the same time you're trying to teach kids how to
be adults?
We're
in the process of decluttering those, though.
I was just going to say academic reform.
Yeah, I love that. But being on the athletic council, I see the incredible restrictions and mazes that our kids have to go through. Mm-hmm. They have to compete, they have to be great academics, and they have to learn how to be adults. How do they balance all that?
You're
stuff?
Right. And I think it goes back to, it's just a credit to our coaches. You have to identify the talent and make sure that it fits within the system that you're operating in. So they really do a wonderful job, as much as the rules will permit, in trying to make sure that that young man or young woman has the ability to be successful here. And I think when you look at the Big Ten 10, in our opinion, being the best conference in the country and being highly competitive, you've got to make sure that someone can manage their time, that they can get it done in all of those respective areas. And I think for us, too, Scott, it's about making sure that we have the support services in place, not only within the athletic department through the provost area, but also being connected with the university system as well. So when you talk to our student athletes during their experiences and during senior exit interviews, I always say, if one's abysmal and 10 is outstanding, what has your experience over these 4 or 5 years been like? And we constantly get 9s, 10s, and 11s where they wouldn't trade it. They come here and they stay here. We see very few transfers because I think the quality of life is so high.
And going back a little bit to the Title IX gender equity piece, the way I kind of define it is Title IX is the law. Gender equity is the right way of doing business. It's creating opportunities. And as you go through an athletic program and you really reach into what we're doing at Michigan State of 25 sports, which ranks, you know, in the upper group, but near the average of the Big Ten. We're a broad-based conference. There are conferences out there that average more in the 18 sports range. And when you're looking at resources and allocating resources, the more you have, obviously, the less per unit gets allocated. And it really becomes a challenge. We have approximately $12 million that go in scholarships. Those get divided pretty close to 50-50. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're within the margins and is always an ongoing challenge. But to really spread those resources among the programs for Shelley, who oversees most all the sports, works with the budgets, it's a daunting task in today's world. And if you want to hit on that a little bit, yeah. Shelley, that
it really is. And I think for us, it's about trying to make sure that we look at scholarship dollars. And that ties back to what you mentioned too, Scott, about the NCAA. They have financial aid limits. So there are certain grant totals that you can put for each sport. And then obviously we manage in-state and out-of-state as well. And then as Mark, you mentioned, we've got operational budgets. We certainly then have the coaches' salaries and benefits. So when you put the whole budget together, you're trying to set it up for as much success as possible and trying to compete within your conference, but also within your region or nationally. So when you take a look at the number of sports that advance to the NCAA, that certainly has been very impressive. And for those that are winning championships, for us to have 5 programs that are winning, and our equity initiative has really helped our women's sports be competitors at the highest level. So I think it has been something that's been very successful. But also, too, when you talk about equity, the initiatives that we've done have helped both men's and women's programs. When Jenison was renovated in 2002, a strength and conditioning area, the training room, the equipment room, those types of things benefit all.
College Field is another great example.
Exactly. So you look out there and see men's and women's soccer and baseball and softball, and people have really been able to take it to another level. So I think that you put the whole menu together, you're trying to put people in a position where they can excel. And certainly for us, it's not about being mediocre or average. It's trying to be a key player in the upper tier of our conference.
The NCAA is going through a transformational time right now in many ways. And some of the contemporary issues that are out there in the media are part of a bigger scheme that the presidents are throwing out. So conversations about cost of attendance, conversations about multi-year scholarships, conversations about initial eligibility, about squad sizes. It's, you know, not to get into the specifics because we're still really trying to figure out what all this is going to mean and impact. But what's your take on the overall global perception of what's happening to NCAA sports right now?
Well, I think when we saw Miles Brand be named president of the NCAA, that was a transformational time because prior to that, it had typically been former athletic directors. So the presidents have really stepped up and said, we're going to provide great leadership. And athletic directors and staffs have tried to certainly follow and add to the equation as well. So as we now look at President Emerit, and certainly President Simon is on that executive council. When they got together this summer and over 50 presidents met for a reform agenda type of retreat, they said, we're going to move some things along quickly. It's not going to be the normal legislative process, and we want to implement change. So get ready, buckle up, we're going to make some moves. And that's exactly what's happening. And as Mark said, the conference conversation, the campus conversations are about how can we be in alignment, what is the financial financial impact. And I think the key for those initiatives are certainly to try to make sure that student-athlete welfare and their quality of life is better, also to help us navigate a rule book that at times has become cumbersome, and we've spent too much time on kind of the minutiae and trying to make sure that the bigger picture is addressed. So I think that this year is really a transformational year, and many of our questions still don't have answers, but we're going to work through it and certainly do our best to make sure that we're in compliance and also trying to be better off after we get through it. But as Mark talked about, too, we've had to balance out some of the equity issues when you look at cost of attendance. And we certainly want to make sure that our coaches continue to have high quality of life, because there's been a lot of burnout tied to this profession. It's 24/7. Technology has done that. So even when we look at recruiting calendars, how can we make sure that our coaches are spending the time they want with their current team, not only trying to balance out then who is going to be the next member of my team through recruiting. So I think the next couple of years are going to be very significant for us.
So what's the pitch with so many different great athletic programs out there? Why should an athlete come to MSU?
Because Scott Westerman is our director of alumni relations, association, and everything else, don't you think?
I get it when you're talking about it.
When I look at it, I mean, I can say, why did I want to come to the Big Ten? Because that was a dream come true for me. I felt like I worked 15 years in the profession to earn the opportunity to hopefully get in the mix to get here. So literally every day I walk into Jenison, and I mean this sincerely, whether my boss was here or not, I just kind of pinch myself and say, this is a really special place. The land-grant mission of Michigan State, our core values, the things that we believe in, it's about access, it's about opportunity, and it's about being a little bit of an underdog and having that blue-collar work ethic that we're going to outwork people and find a way to win, but do it the right way. So I think for our student-athletes, they get a top-notch education. They have all of the support services in the world to help them be successful. And when you look at athletically, you want to compete with and against the best, and we're set up to do that. And they are coached by some of the most outstanding people. And when you have a Mark Hollis, when you have a Scott Westerman, a President Simon, and others that are visionary, that are creative, that are always finding a way to do something special, I think it puts you literally in a class by yourself. And so when I look at Michigan State, our student athletes know that they have an opportunity to pursue their dreams and to achieve them in this environment. And I think that's really why it all works.
Shelley Applebaum is Senior Associate Director of Athletics at Michigan State University. Would you like to do a job like Mark someday?
It's interesting. When I see what he goes through on certain days, I just want to be here for him to help in whatever way I can. I've certainly thought about it, and I've had a few opportunities over the years. But I will tell you that for me, in the role that I have, I still feel like I can make a difference. And Mark is wonderful at allowing us to – he tells us what the lane lines are, but he gives us a lot of freedom to try to go out there and make a difference. My role is to serve him and our coaches and our student athletes, and I have a lot of fun doing it. And so for me, Scott, you know, I've made a decision on a number of occasions now that this is really where I want to be. I still think that I want to continue to gain more skills and add to my toolbox so that if that opportunity came up, I would be prepared. But I think in many ways for us day to day, he wants people that have the capacity to be the AD, maybe not be in that particular title or role, but have the skill set so that when he is out trying to raise money and keep this whole thing moving forward, he has people at home that can try to help out and make sure that we're moving in the right direction. So I think it's really about knowing your role and being happy with it, and I very much am.
I do. I believe it's we try to create an environment where people have an opportunity to be included in every process that we do within the athletic department. And we have a group of individuals that could go out tomorrow and get athletic directors' jobs in this country, and it's a competitive environment. And, you know, Shelley's right there at the top of individuals who have the skill set, who have the personality to tackle things like that. And it's a blessing as an AD to have that. I also think, you know, back to your question about Michigan State, you know, some of the values that I see here, it's unusual to have a set of coaches who interact and assist each other like they do at Michigan State. And you take that one level farther, you talk about the president and her staff and our advancement team, our alumni team, folks all across campus, really, when something comes to the point where it's going to bring pride or there's a concern or an issue. It's amazing how people on this campus come together and help either support or push people to that next level. One of the things like you that I like to do is walk around campus. The new Starbucks in the middle of campus has given me a new destination for a walk. I walk when I'm stressed, and I've been walking a whole lot lately. So it's an opportunity to get out and talk to students and talk to faculty. And, you know, I think that's, we all have jobs like everybody else, but that's the one value that we have in working on a campus like this, is that ability to be around students, to be around student athletes, and to be around other people that are very energetic and part of a great campus.
Success attracts attention. We saw that with Dan Gilbert and Tom Izzo. Are you a Spartan for life?
I sure do hope so. It's I hope I have a way to give back to this university for many years to come. So whatever role that may be, the athletic director's longevity nowadays is somewhere between 5 and 7 years, and I'm quickly approaching that, and I hope it doesn't come to an end at that point in time. But you try and make decisions every day, many of those as if you're drinking from a fire hose, where issues are thrown at you on a constant basis. And as long as you can make decisions that in your heart you feel like is the best decision, and hopefully is accepted by those that you serve, which is our student athletes and our alumni base and our campus community, I hope to be here for a long, long time.
Couldn't close it any better way than that. Shelley Applebaum has been our guest. Thanks for being with us.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
That was MSU Alumni Association Executive Director Scott Westerman and Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis talking with one of Mark's most trusted senior associates in Spartan Athletics, Shelley Applebaum. To hear their conversation again, or President Simon's sustainability-focused conversation with Kirk Heinze from the first part of our show today, please visit SpartanPodcast.com.
I'm Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association. Whether you're moving across town or across the country, relocating to a new job or a new city is always a challenge. When you join the MSU Alumni Association family, wherever you go, you'll have an instant circle of friends on hand to help you get settled and get connected. With more than 100 clubs and affiliates around the world, there's a Spartan in just about every city. And as an MSU Alumni Association member, you'll quickly feel right at home. Wherever you go, community, connections, careers, and class, 4 great reasons to visit alumni.msu.edu today to activate your membership in the largest Spartan organization in the world. That's alumni.msu.edu, the Michigan State University Alumni Association, your personal network for life.
MSU Ag Bio Research, leading innovation in food, natural resources, and energy.
Well, one of the things we want listeners to know is how connected we are, that we're in a response mode of addressing real life problems in the real world here in Michigan.
Dr. Steve Pepke leads MSU Ag Bio Research.
Well, we're everywhere. We're the face of MSU across the state, in the local communities, with infrastructure and research expertise to address those local problems. MSU Ag Bioresearch is the research engine that undergirds the food and agricultural industry in the state, that undergirds our natural resource usage, recreational usages of sport, fishing, forestry, all of those things. And, of course, with the recent interest in renewable energy, we have in a very big way moved into this arena as well.
MSU Ag Bioresearch. Thank you for listening, and please join us every Sunday at 4 o'clock for MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.